This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community. Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word. Coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome, family and friends, fans and fiends, to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I am Benjamin Norris, and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guest is one of them. This man was born in Melbourne, and while his writing has won him critical acclaim, it's been his courage to explore his traditional Greek heritage as an Australian man that has made him an undeniably fascinating author. His writing is laced with a provocative and controversial overtone that leaves the reader always debating the character's morals and ethics. Whether it's his best-selling novels like the award-winning The Slap and Barracuda, or even the cult success of Dead Europe and Loaded, you never walk away unscathed by the upfront nature of anguish, sexual desire, and cultural politics. And compelled to investigate his masculinity in this complex world, it is that very title that he has explored harder and faster than any other author of his generation. His work is that of legends, with so much of his storytelling being translated into cinema and television programs, which has captivated a worldwide audience. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Christos Tsiolkos to Word for Word.
Where I was really blessed was being an avid reader. I was born an Australian child, but because I grew up in this Greek world, I didn't speak any English.
My mum has this story. She says I was about 10 at the time, and that I turned around to her and said, "Mum, I'm going to be a writer."
Christos Tsiolkos is an award-winning author, as well as a playwright, essayist, and screenwriter.
My name's Christos Tsiolkos. I'm a writer. That's one of the things I am.
No one deserves to be hit, let alone a child.
Hugo's problem is not that Harry gave him a slap. Hugo's problem is that you and Gary let him act like an absolute brat.
That's enough.
I say, look at your parents. Hard-working migrants, work two jobs, struggle all your life, buy your kids a house. There, yeah, that's purpose.
Welcome to the show.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Benjamin. I really, I'm sorry I'm hard to get, but I've been waiting to do this interview.
I like that you're hard to get. That makes this more exclusive, I think. You know what? I've brought all of your books in.
I can see, and all library books.
I had a friend of mine saying that, you know, oh, well, you've got to get Christos to sign them, but I don't necessarily know if you can sign library books.
I think I would probably get charged.
Imagine that, defaming the book or defacing the book.
I could face a jail sentence.
You know, a lot of your work, I find that there's similar themes where there's the underdog, the outsider. There's a lot of depictions of self-loathing and things like that that has happened throughout your life. And these themes sort of resurface in different ways. Was that all very conscious when you were writing?
Look, I do think there are always obsessions that an individual has, an individual artist has, that comes out in the work they do. Mm. I think mine are about masculinity, are about family. And shame, when you talk about self-loathing, I think it's got to do with heritage and the background that I've got. I think it actually protected me in lots of ways, because I've got, coming from a really strong family where love was never an issue, you know, and that's not everyone's experience. I'm really fortunate there. I also had my mum was fiercely independent and my dad was a really gentle man, and that is a good combination, I think, for a young queer kid.
Absolutely.
Growing up. But at the same time, you know, they were a strict Greek family at a time when they were migrants to this country. They were quite fearful of my exploring the Australian world. And with a lot of communities, not only Greek, but, migrants from across the globe, and also traditional Aussie communities and traditional Aboriginal communities even, the notion of shame is really strong. That, you know, that your first loyalty is family, but the second And sometimes as equally important is to community. So what will the community think? And I think that's that suddenly realizing in my late childhood, early teens that I was, you know, for want of a better word, a pusti, a pufta, and realizing that that meant that at some point I was going to have to deal with that struggle in the community itself, that made me really conscious of shame and how shame works. And I think because where I was really blessed was being an avid reader from really, really early on, I gravitated to the outsider in the novel, in the story. Yeah. So in that way, I don't know if it was conscious when I first started writing, but I had been influenced by the story of the outsider. And I think it came in that first writing. When you write your fuff, I say this because it's absolutely true. When I wrote my first novel, Loaded, I had no idea if I was ever going to do this again. And you don't know if you're ever going to do it. You know,
really?
You dream. I was, and look, you know, there weren't creative writing courses. They weren't, you know, it was a dream that I had. And I'd been writing from really, really young in exercise books. And I had those dreams of being a writer. That was really, I guess that was a core dream from childhood. But I didn't grow up in a literary world. I didn't know writers. I didn't know artists. It just felt like that was an impossible dream.
How amazing. We're going to get into a lot more of this. You were born in 1965 and you grew up in Melbourne. What would you say your childhood was like?
I think absolutely blessed. And I mean that it was, you know, you could objectively say it was a hard childhood in the sense that I was a working class child of migrant parents. So it's not like we had a lot, but what we had was absolute safety. It was a time where we all lived in close proximity to each other. So I lived in close proximity to my two cousins, Vicky and Bill, who I loved and could see them all the time. We kids ruled the streets. You know, there was school, and, you know, you walked to school and no one ever thought of, you know, walking your kid to school. I mean, there was
stranger danger like that.
It was before that. And also, you know, this was in Richmond. My parents worked in factories that were literally down the road. So, you know, I probably knew three quarters of the street I grew up in.
Yeah,
that memory of the streets is what I cherish. Just the other day, I was driving. I had my cousin out from Grace Goslandinos, and there was a circus at the Oval, at Burnley Oval, and we used to go there every time the circus was in town. And again, you know, no supervision. And the carnies were terrific. They loved us kids, and, like, they would take us in, and they would get us to play with the animals, and, you know, you'd probably be arrested.
These days, you'd be arrested.
And, there's a story I tell about. I mean, I want to say this because I remember about, it's over 10 years ago now, but my partner Wayne and I, we were traveling in the Middle East and we were in Amman in Jordan, and we were walking down a street just in, you know, in the city there, and I started the sentence. I said, Wayne, have you noticed? And he finished it. It was like we had it at the same time. He went, yeah, look at all the kids. And there were little girls playing versions of hopscotch. There were boys playing football. The sound of children was everywhere. And I thought, that's what my childhood was like. And I haven't seen that in Australia for a really long time, Benjamin.
How would you describe that era in the late 60s in Richmond, you know, sort of the 60s and 70s, for the Greek culture that you're in?
It was so Greek in the sense that, look, to, you know, the best way to introduce that or to make sense for it for people was, so I was born here. I was born, you know, at what is now the QV shopping mall in the city, the hospital there. So, you know, I was born an Australian child, but because I grew up in this Greek world, I didn't speak any English until I went to school, and we didn't do kindergarten back then. So I went straight to primary school, and I was completely shocked that suddenly there was this woman at the front of the class speaking in this language that I'd kind of heard on television, but I really didn't know. And so for the first 6 months of my primary school, I was put in a class with recently arrived immigrant kids who were largely from Turkey and Lebanon back then, because I didn't know any English. I had to do kind of being in this special class to learn the language. And I do keep saying that when critics attack me, I sometimes go, well, that's because English is my second language. But in all honesty, I actually think it gave me, well, to your question, that's what the world I grew up in was like. It was very heavily migrant. And if you look at the school photograph, Ben, there's only about three or four Anglo kids. The rest of us are from largely at that time the Turkey and Southern Europe. And so I felt at that time, as a little kid, being part of that world was terrific, because our houses were full of every Saturday night, Friday night or Saturday night, someone was having a party. And in that, I think, Mediterranean way, kids are part of that. You go out and play in the street and then come back in and someone's got the guitar out and they're playing. The women are cooking up fabulous meals in the kitchen. The party's going to late at night. Often, maybe every second week, we would be going down to the National Theatre in Richmond or the Westgarth in Northcote, and there would be Greek movies. And again, the same thing. You know, the adults would be watching the film, but often we kids would be sliding down the banisters, playing in Bridge Road. Again, you'd get arrested now if you let your kid play.
It'd be like turning up at your house. Did you leave your child outside?
Absolutely joyous for that youthful part of my life. I think the great change for me, and I don't know if it was similar for you as well, was the coming of adolescence and the slow... Was it slow? It wasn't slow. It was actually, I think, the realisation... I really mean this. I knew that I loved boys, men, from late primary school. Like, I knew it. Like,
but then what age did you go through puberty, though?
I probably started early.
See, for me, I didn't go through puberty. This is going to sound odd to you, but I didn't go through puberty till I was 18.
Wow, okay.
So I was so unaware of boys. I wanted to be friends with boys and girls. And I had no lustful feelings or anything.
Very different to me.
So, yeah, like what you were saying, it's gradual, it's slow, but then it's very quick. So I think, you know, for you personally, once you got to that age, it all would have changed quite quickly.
It did. And that's a really an observation that I want to think about, because I think you're absolutely right. I think I must have gone through puberty quite early on. The way it was in my imagination was... back then, if I'm trying to kind of access what was going through my head, it was partly was like going, oh, well, I'm Greek. We get the beard, we get hairy earlier. And I do remember that suddenly, it's like a punch, that hormonal rush that comes with puberty, because suddenly the world, it's really interesting hearing what you said, because it suddenly does change. Suddenly you realize, yeah, and you suddenly, your relationship with even your best friend, your best mate, who you a few weeks ago were swapping football cards with and playing marbles and just being kids, suddenly you're aware of feelings that seem dangerous, and you're certainly suspicious, because all you've gleaned is that these feelings should be directed towards girls. If you've got them, the world of sex has been a mystery. You know it's there. You've heard things. You've sensed things, but you've been protected from it. But for me, in late primary school, I suddenly entered that consciousness. And then in my second year of high school, my parents moved out from Richmond and, you know, a bit of that migrant dream, went out to Box Hill North and went to Blackburn High. And... so I was really in the midst of kind of teenagehood then, and I'd gone at that time, unlike what it is, you know, Box Hill is quite an Asian Australian population.
It is now, yeah.
But back then it was really white. It was really white. And I remember, because halfway through year eight, going into the classroom, and I was looking around and going, they're all really blonde. And just thinking, am I the only wog here? And it was a real shock.
Yeah.
So, well, you know, so there, I've painted an idyllic, because I think it was an idyllic childhood. But I think whatever, even if we had stayed in Richmond, I think there would have been issues that would have brought me to a sense of crisis to do with sexuality. Because what sexuality did was remove me from a world that I felt really comfortable in. You know, I'd already begun to think, I don't know how to be Greek. You know, I don't know, because I'm not like my best mate, you know, because I want to sleep with him, you know, I want to have sex with him. That makes me a pervert. That makes me
It's a huge struggle to go through. What's odd to me is that it's such a young age to cope with complex issues.
Well, you can't... you live in this state of... And I hope that this is changing, because I think this is really... I mean, this is part of the experience that is... there's no better word for it. It's terrifying, is that you feel like you can't speak of it to the people you love most in the world. And you're still a young child. You're a child. And the people you love most in the world are your parents, your family, your best friends. And you go, I can't... If I confess even a part of this, I will be exiled.
Yeah, what's going to happen to me?
And that's a terror that I think is what creates so much of the psychological pain of being queer, you know. And yes, as I said, I hope that that's changing.
Starting to diminish a little bit.
Where I go, again, I keep coming back to books, I keep coming back to art, I keep coming back to films, Ben, is that that's where I was able... I mean, they saved me. I really think that, because it was in reading, in going to the movies, that I thought, oh, okay, you know,
there's other opportunity out there.
Exactly, exactly.
If you had have just been isolated to your feelings and having no understanding of there being lives and worlds outside of that, you'd probably think, well, where do I go from here?
Well, I think there are the only options then are a complete retreat into, you know, into silence. I mean, that's what the closet is, you know. It's just like kind of, or I don't know what, I mean, self-destruction. I mean, if you really have no opportunities to find an echo of your reality anywhere, that's incredibly difficult. And there's, you know, we're talking about it in terms of sexuality, but I think that sometimes can, I mean, not, so, I think that's often part of the experience of racism. I don't want to be I'm not an expert on racism, because I'm not a person of color, but I, growing up a WOG in this country and growing up a WOG in that particular time, gives me some relationship to it, and as part of that reading.
But they're different ways of being marginalized.
They are very, very different. I think that's, you know, for example, I think a black person growing up in an all-white town, there's an element of going, where am I going to, you know, if you don't have books, if you don't have images, if you don't have a sense of that there is a confirmation that I am also of this world, that's a really hard experience.
What about this relationship you had with your father?
My dad did this really sweet thing, because he was really proud that I read, you know, from primary school. He was really, because he didn't come from a culture.
Yeah.
You know, he came from World War II and the Civil War. He didn't come from schooling. He didn't have access to education. And so, and he was, you know, he made a huge decision to come to this country, a family of 12, you know, largely to send money back to Greece, working in factories here. But every Thursday he would stop at a little news agency that was in Bridge Road in Richmond, close to where I grew up, and he would buy two books with his paycheck. And because he couldn't read English, sometimes it would be Mills and Boom he'd give me, sometimes it would be Charles Dickens, but he gave me, I remember, my first Harold Robbins, and I was about 9 or 10. He gave me Henry Miller, and I remember struggling with Henry Miller, like really struggling, and the language is so difficult and the concepts are so sophisticated, and I can't say that I understood any of it, but I was like, I just, something in me went, I've got to keep trying, that there's something about literature that if I'm ever going to crack, I'm going to have to do this work. So I feel always grateful for my dad doing that.
Now, with your parents, I mean, your parents were quite protective in the sense that, you know, your dad armed you with literature. So even in that way, your parents had such a really positive impact, and you were lucky to have them. What was their relationship like between each other as you were growing up?
So my parents' marriage was arranged. So there was, in a way, I knew that, knowing that there wasn't a kind of the great romance. And I think the early years were difficult for mum and dad, because it was a struggle. And I think whenever there's economic struggle, that affects the relationship. So there was, apart from that going on, they had different ways of understanding their migration. So for my father, his memories, and I only learned this later, I mean, it's one of the things that, you know, my dad's experiences as a young man were quite horrific, because he was a late teen in a civil war in Greece that in many ways was uglier than what happened in World War II. And he saw things that no person should see. He never talked about those things, right? He never talked about those things. And it was only when I went to Greece as an adult that my relatives told me. And I remember coming back here and he was furious at them for having revealed these experiences. And that they are, you know, they are nothing I have undergone in my life comes close to what my father had to go through. And he was like, this is why I migrated, because I knew if I had children, I never wanted them to experience this. And he loved his country. He loved his family. But he was deeply suspicious of Greece because of the experience he saw. And there was an image. He didn't know Goya. He didn't know art. But, you know, there's the famous painting of Goya sat and eating his children.
Yeah.
And he would always say about Greece, Greece eats its children. And just before he died was... You know, Greece was again in an economic crisis that happened after the GFC. And I remember him on the hospital bed talking about Greece and saying that again, it eats its children all the time. So even though he felt the loss of home and family, he was really happy to be here. I think my mother, one, but she was the only one who migrated from her family. She always wished she was back in Greece. So I think in terms of my parents' relationship, that was a real struggle early on. You know, Mum wanted to go back. You know, Dad was really happy here, and I think that, so. You're young, and you don't really know. You just know that there's, you know, they're screaming at each other, and they always seem to be screaming about Greece, and you don't quite understand it. I think that changed when we were older, and Dad went back to Greece in the early 70s, and it was the period of a junta, and again, you know, Greece eats its children. You know, he came back. And he decisively said, there is no way I am going to take my children back to that country. That's under a military dictatorship. And I think Mum came to...
She realised that
she
as well.
Went, we can't do that as well. And so I think they made a decision to stay here and stay together. And I think in terms of that, both a kind of stoicism and a kind of honour... about family and...
Family values.
It's hard because in a way we don't have the language for it anymore because we live in a much more individualistic world. I do too, you know. But that kind of sense of there are obligations that you have to honour was something that was very paramount for both my father and for my mother. And... I think that has had an influence on the way I want to live my life and conduct my life. So, you know, I think I've talked about this with Wayne a lot because we're 33 years together, which is a long time. We were really young when we met, and his parents are immigrants as well from Holland, and they I think have theirs is a different history, but they also have elements of that. Or that bedrock of what honour is and what responsibility is. And I think Wayne and I both share it. So even when things have become really hard, we really think it's important to work at the things that you want to honour that is best in a relationship. I mean, I'm really lucky because I love the man to frickin' eternity. You know,
it's so nice.
He saves me.
That.
But I think there's also that comes from my parents. So they gave me, I think they've given me, that sense of honour, and they've given me a real sense of love, and yeah, that, you know, I know I'm lucky. Not everyone gets to have that in families, unfortunately. And what they also gave me was their language. I think it's really, I resented it as a young child having to go to Greek school, but as a writer, there is nothing more splendid than knowing another language, because even my first language is English, really, you know, that's what I write in, but I can in writing I can sometimes think in Greek, and I can think of what happens if I translate back and forth between these two languages, what do I do with the English language. That's, you know, I keep saying this is one thing that the Anglo phonic world that we're part of does not get how important language is. And, you know, I just think, you know, when I talk to young kids and they say, I want to be an artist or I want to be a writer, I say, then you've got to do a bloody language, because that will be a skill that you can use in your practice, regardless of what it is, because it will make you think in a different way.
A different way of storytelling as well.
And look at the English language. You know, one of my favourite books is Lolita Nabokov. You know, he learned English as an, you know, that's not his language. He was Russian, he spoke French, then English. Joseph Conrad.
You know, some of the best storytellers.
And some of the best English writing in the world. And I think that's not accidental that they were, because they knew about language, because they had to work at understanding and translating the world into different languages. And that's what you do as a writer, is you're translating an experience of the world into a language that you as a reader can
understand.
I was going to, can I just say actually to that, but it did help when I was young, you know, because they couldn't read my work in English. So
That's also handy.
That was handy, but the Loader did get translated into, all the books have been translated into Greek, which, and you know, Dad was an absolute sweetheart. I did give him the Greek translation of Loaded, and he said, "Oh, Christo, I tried for 3 or 4 pages and then went, I can't do this." You know, it wasn't a kind of, I understood that. I was really glad that he lived long enough to read the slap, and particularly to read the section called Manonius, which is about the old Greek man, because Dad was in my head all the time when I was writing that.
I can imagine.
Yeah. That early period, I think, made me a little, I was able to be fearless in the writing because I knew my parents couldn't read it. And I'm only saying that because you're young, you know, when you start writing. And I know, you know, I've had lots of conversations with writer friends and that, you know, it is a concern, especially if you want to do something that is challenging or
really honest.
Or really honest, yeah.
Do you want to sit down and have a really honest, frank, you know, conversation about sex and love and relationship and the things that people do, you know, with your parents?
Exactly. No, I mean, you want to have, you know, I think you want to get to a point of truth, but you don't necessarily want to reveal every little detail, every, having said that, and because I know you know Jill Bilcock, who was the editor on Head On, that was the film that Anna Kokkinos adopted from Loaded, and the Greek translation hadn't come out. And so the first insight my mum had into the book was going to the cinema together to see a screening of Head On. And it was a really, you know, she's coming blind to this. She's heard a little bit about the book, and the film starts and she just won't look at me. She's just staring at the screen, and then the only point that she reacts is, and she just bashes me with her elbow, is a scene where the protagonist, Ari, is shooting up drugs. That's her way of saying,
not okay with
that. Not okay with that. Film finishes and she goes to the loos at the Nova. It was at the Nova Cinemas in Carlton, and she is in there for 10, 15. It felt like she was in there for hours. And I was really terrified. I mean, I'm laughing about it now, but I was. Because
she's had an overdose of Valium.
Exactly. It's like,
she's like, oh, God.
You know, what the poor, you know, what she's gone through and how is she making sense of it? She knows I'm gay, but, you know, this film is quite revealing of so many aspects.
So revealing.
Right. Anyway, she comes out and she says, let's go and get a drink. And I'm forever grateful to everyone involved in that film, because we just ended up at a pub in Carlton and smashed so many whiskies and got really, really drunk, but got really honest. And not in a, as I said, you know, but it was wonderful. It was suddenly something broke in her and she could ask all the questions she wanted to ask. And I could ask some of the questions that I wanted to ask and was nervous of asking. And it was, yeah, so I'm really grateful.
Christos, who shocked each other more? Like, did you shock your mum with your stories or did she shock you with hers?
I think Head On was the shock for mum, because though she knew these things, she didn't want to imagine. She had an experience of that film that no one else in the world has had, which is the mother watching that film.
So your mum is consistently questioning.
Yeah.
Is this what I see on screen? Was my son taking drugs? Was my son having dangerous, promiscuous sex? That's terrifying.
Exactly. Hence the elbow.
I'd be getting more than an elbow. If that was my mum, if I said, I mean, I've been very honest with my mum about certain things in my life. You know, there's some things that I guess you don't feel the need or it's not necessary to tell
you. It isn't necessary to.
You know, but then as an artist and a creator and a writer for you, who's had so much of your work translated into film, it's unescapable. Whilst I think a lot of people probably shut the door and don't have honest conversations with their parents.
I think there is a period of, you know, this is in the writing, it's in the stories. There is a period where I think it is necessary to, no matter what the relationship is with your family, and this isn't only about sexuality, right? I think there is an element, we all do this, that you have to forge your own life and you have to kind of, you've got to go through that. I mean, I'm an old existentialist in that sense. I really believe that you have to work out what is important to you, you know, as Benjamin Norris in the world, as Christos Tsolkas in the world, what is it that matters? And part of forging that path, like finding that path rather, is having to have, is to separate yourself from family. I think it's also having at a point to go, I can also try and separate myself from the culture that I thought is the whole world and try and get new experiences, try to understand people I've never tried to understand before. But really, what is it that I am in the world, to me, is a fundamental question that goes beyond any identity. It's just fundamental to how we live our life. How do I live? I mean, Barracuda, which is a novel that I've always said felt like starting writing again, is actually telling the Loaded story in a different way, because it is, you know, I've gone back to this young character, but the boy's and the man's struggle in Barracuda is, how is it that I can live a good life? What is it to be a good man in this world, a good person in this world? I was really conscious as soon as I started that novel that was what it's about, because I think that's the fundamental question for me.
I think navigating your own narrative for me is really important. And my mum consistently said to me my whole life, you have to be true to yourself. Focus harder on what it is that you want. I mean, your happiness is your happiness. You know, if you're going to spend your whole life trying to create happiness for your parents or for your friends or for other people, I don't think you're ever going to experience true happiness.
Well, that was a really hard lesson for, like many of us, you want to be liked. I wanted to be liked. And I think the lesson I had to learn was that you can't do that in the world. You can't be something for everyone. You really have to
be true to yourself.
Well, yeah, as you said, be true to yourself. And so the first, for me, you know, part of that was learning how to be true to myself within the context of family. And that's what I meant, you know, that there was that necessarily. I had to move away physically, but also emotionally for a while. Well, I was lucky, the connection of love was never lost there, but it was, you know, I had to get a sense of who was Christos Tsolkas. And now at this point, I can look back and go, yes, I have an inheritance that comes from both my mother and my father. I have an inheritance that is cultural as well as the familial and the emotional. I'm really proud of all that. But I'm also not my mother and my father. And that's why I got a little bit, you know, I just hesitated about telling their stories, because the truth is they should tell their stories, because they're going to tell their stories in a different way, because they know their stories more truthfully than I do.
I get that, but in the same time as well, my grandfather passed away, and he was a great storyteller, and I tell his stories now, but that's in honour of him, you know? And I think I love that he lives on still by the art of storytelling, you know? Yeah, and I think my storytelling as well comes from him, and I love that heritage passes down. You know,
you're absolutely right, actually. You know,
I'm sure that my boyfriend goes, I've heard that story about your grandfather before. I don't want to hear it again. Means nothing to him.
I think, my friend, that's part of being a boyfriend.
Yeah, exactly. It's endurance.
Endurance is actually a really good word. Thinking about a lot about this conversation we've been having, because it's endurance, and it makes it sound like it's all struggle, and it's not. It's also absolute pleasure. But there is an endurance that you need to stay committed to someone. Right.
Uh-huh.
And really, yeah. You need that. And there's an endurance you need to become a good reader and a good writer. And the endurance, you know, as a child about, you know, learning to be patient, that you can't have everything at once.
I know.
I'm going to take that word away from the conversation we've had. And you've changed my mind. You're right. We can.
You can be
with an honour tell our stories. Because the Slap Manolius, which is the the central for me story, well, you know, it's the spine really to the slap, is I owe to my father and to so many peers of his generation, and a lot of Dead Europe comes from my father's and my mother's art with story. Mm. You know, the way they, especially my dad, talked to me about growing up in a village, and I used it. I consciously used that storytelling.
So I get quite emotional when I hear people telling their stories of their, because family is important to me. And when I hear other people unearthing stories from their family and that they feel passionate about telling their stories, I connect to it in a way. But I love storytelling, though.
You know, just hearing that, you know, one thing that I think, just listening to you, that I really like is the importance of family to you as well.
Mm.
And I think there was a sense, maybe it was a myth we migrant communities told ourselves as a defense against xenophobia and stuff, but it was like family wasn't as important to Australians. And I think that's absolutely untrue. Like, and when I say Australians, I mean Anglo-Australians, right? I just think it takes the acknowledgement of it is, it's kind of expressed in different ways, but it feels like a really good and positive change, or a beginning of a good and positive change in Australian culture, that we are becoming more at ease with talking about what family means. Because it was really hard.
I take religion out of it, I take society out of it, and I place it not about being an Australian or anything like that. I think, to me personally, it's luck. Like, for you, you had luck.
Oh, God,
in the
yeah.
fact that you had your mum and your dad, yeah. and that they were these amazing people. Yeah. And I think for myself, I have this luck that I had these, a mum and a dad and their parents that I had important relationships with. And that's so enriching for who I am as a person. And I think most of our lives we're self-obsessed and we sort of want to explore who we are and know who we are. And that all comes from our family.
I do not disagree at all. And fortune, you know, and luck, their words I use a lot because I do. And that's not a way of, you know, that's not false humility. That I just think you've got to understand that there are things that come through fortune. You know, I was lucky to have the parents I had. I was lucky that I was published in the 90s at a point where these young women were coming into the publishing industry who were no longer scared of queer writing.
Was there a time when, not something sexual, but when was there first knowledge that there was gay people?
I remember Midnight Cowboy, the John Schlesinger movie, was on television one night. And I can tell you I was in primary school. At what age I was, I'm not sure. And I am forever grateful that my parents had no concept of censorship, clearly.
They're letting you watch whatever you like.
Yeah. And there was the scene where John Voight, as the hustler, is the guy's going down on him and then doesn't have the money to pay. And I'm just thinking, oh, my God. You know,
That's two men together.
That's two men together.
How old were you when you're watching that?
Look, again, it would have been late years of primary school, but around that time.
But I think, you know, there's so many people who relate to that. I remember SBS was a source of information for a lot of generations of people tapping into things that maybe wasn't the right age, you know, to be watching it. But as parents, I guess you can't be too strict with censorship either.
I think there was a sense that, in a way, coming from the worlds of poverty, the worlds of World War II, the worlds of a civil war, there's nothing on television that they thought could... They weren't scared of those kind of images.
Mm.
Because compared to what I think they had seen, particularly what my father had seen, they were not frightening. So to use the word fortune again, I'm fortunate that they didn't try to censor those images. This is later, so this is, I knew there were gay people and I was terrified that I was one of them. But I'm just thinking of those moments where someone you respect can lead you into, can just offer your hand as a young person. So the Patrick White book is dedicated to a high school teacher I had, Yaroslav Havia. And we never talked, he was one of the world's great teachers. We never talked about me being gay because I was still too scared of even articulating it, certainly not to a high school teacher, but he introduced me to the world of European books. And I can see now that he steered me. He steered me towards people like André Gide and, you know, the books that are central to my reading life. And
it opened your mind, but it also gave you some some role models to have, I guess.
Exactly. And that generosity and that kindness of just one individual teacher can change a life. That's why I think, you know, I just think education there's so central. But there's also a moment, and for a lot of your listeners, you will have, you may not know this band, but there was a terrific film reviewer called Ivan Hutchinson,
yeah,
who in Melbourne in the 70s and 80s, and he was a great writer on film, and he also used to have a show on Channel 7 about film, you know, introducing great films. And he had a screening of a film called Making Love that was one of the first Hollywood commercial films that featured gay characters, Michael Ottken. Anyway, I went to a screening. I heard about it because I was a film geek from a really early age. And Ivan Hutchinson wasn't gay himself, but he introduced the film with the most eloquent defense of sexual liberty. And
can you remember what he said?
Just that this is part of the human experience, you know, that the some of the greatest people in my life are gay men and lesbians, that it is paraphrasing.
Wow.
But it was that kind of powerful moment to hear someone you respected, and I respected Ivan Hutchinson, say that was a huge release. So just to your question, it made me think of that moment, that those things are...
It's such a rare moment that not a lot of people of our generation would have ever had.
And so that's why I am, in terms of a coming to... Yeah, just a coming to as a young person, young queer person, I'm really grateful for that moment.
If you could give some advice to yourself as a 12-year-old, say as you came in as a 12-year-old now, what advice would you give yourself?
To keep reading, to not believe that you had to make a choice between, I really mean this, a choice between art and sport, that you can do both.
Because you like your football.
Yeah, but I did. I came of an age where it seemed to be that you're either a jock or a poofter. It was like, you know, the Breakfast Club. It just somehow had to be one or the other. You couldn't be both. I would give that advice to myself. I would say don't be so hard on yourself, and I would also say, you know, get a job earlier. Learn independence earlier, because that's really important. Yeah, I think that those are the main things I would say to myself. In all seriousness, because of the age, I was really, you know, again, fortune, knowing what I know now, would have said there's something called safe sex that you've never had to think about, and you should think about it, because, you know, I started being sexually active at 15, and I started using drugs not long after, and the grace of God, really, or the saying that as a non-believer, let's say, just really fortunate, because HIV/AIDS was the defining, it was a key political experience of my life, because I came to of age as a young adult queer man at a time when people...
It was dangerous to be that.
It was dangerous to be that. People who were friends, people who I loved, people who were around me were getting sick and dying. And so that's probably something, you know, I'm being serious, but I need to be serious about that. That would have been a piece of advice that I would have given my younger self, because I was taking... You know, the risks, you know, I could have been me. I think that was always something that really...
Well, if you're experimenting with drugs and you're being promiscuous, I mean, they're that's the danger zone.
Well, exactly.
Where were you getting your hands on drugs at that age?
You know, statute of limitations. I was one of my best friends at school. And look, another thing, you know, talk that I'm thankful to my parents is I had to keep it to the weekends. I had to keep it to holidays, because my parents had a really strict...
They knew what was going on.
They knew what was going on, and so I didn't have the freedom to go out in the way some of my Anglo friends did. But that restraint was important, because I was hungry for experiences.
Because what sort of drugs were you experimenting with?
Speed was, dope, you know, marijuana, but... It was speed that was a drug that I just loved, and I loved it from the first time I took it.
How similar to Ari in Loaded is your life, though? Like, there's sections of the book and there's scenes in the film where Ari is injecting speed and going out and exploring Melbourne and being sexual Is that a direct reenactment of your life at the time?
I mean, I was, yes. I think one of the fears I had when we suddenly started getting knowledge of what this, what AIDS was that I had been using drugs intravenously as well. So that, you know, that put me in really
high risk categories.
So I was terrified the first time I went for the test because of that, because I kind of straddled both those experiences. But so did lots of people.
I mean, it was something that people were doing at the time. I mean, drugs are still prevalent today. You know, there's hopefully less of it. And statistics are saying that younger people are drinking less, you know, which is also quite amazing.
I think the healthier you are psychologically, the less you... I mean, I will always... You know, it's an aging body, so I can't do drugs the way
If I had drugs now, I'd probably have a heart attack, a stroke.
But the, you know, I'm not going to pretend to be. You know, there's also pleasures that came from drugs that are invaluable, really, and experiences that I will cherish because you can have some astonishing moments, you know, in celebration, but they. You know, they also for a period became what happens with addiction. They became a crutch, and that was no longer about the pleasure or conviviality. It was just a way of going through the day. And I knew I had a problem then. Drug stuff is always so difficult to talk about. That's where, again, the politics of extremes is kind of destroying us a little. But I remember that I say this often, but it's really true. I remember the last time I was proud politically of where we were as Australians was at the beginning of the 90s, and I was travelling, you know, I'd gone to Greece and then travelling through Europe and ended up in the US for the first time. And, you know, at that point we had some of the best drug and HIV policy in the world. You know, we had needle exchange programs. We had really a health system that was not, you know, that wasn't about punishment. That was actually about treating this as a disease and let us take the best care we can. You forget about that. You forget about how actually socially progressive we were as a nation in those years. And it feels a little, well, more than a little. It's sad to feel that confidence we had back then has gone. Been replaced by fear and anxiety.
Well, I think that's the problem with politics these days. It probably has gone downhill a little bit in the ways in which we tackle things because of fear and because we're scared to admit the truth. And when you're scared to admit the truth, you're not actually handling the truth.
That's another thing I would tell the really young Christos Tsolkas, is not to be scared, to not be as scared, that a life lived in fear is not a good life. I think that would be solid advice.
I think at the same time, I don't necessarily see you as someone that's ever been governed by fear, because in all of your writing, with all of your books are passionate, vibrant, expressive, dangerous stories in some ways. So I don't really see that fear in you.
Of course. I mean,
I don't know. You can't really go back and change things in a way, you know what I mean?
And you don't want to. You know, you know, every single step is which leads you to this moment that I am sitting across a desk from you. Every single step, you know, that's the realization of time and history. I know that fearlessness came from experience, and it came from taking a leap of faith. That I had to pursue the kind of life I wanted, the writing life I wanted, the individual life I wanted, the sexual life I wanted. There is a moment that marks that for me too. I used to be quite religious. I didn't grow up very... I mean, Mum in particular has a really strong Orthodox faith, but married, thankfully, to a real anti-clerical. I think that's what differentiates us Orthodox from the Catholics. Mm. Even though the rituals can be quite similar, Mum's faith in God has got nothing to do with respecting priests. She knows priests can be good people, but she knows they can also be venal and do terrible things because she's seen it happen. And I think because the Orthodox clergy are married, you know, my great uncle is a priest, and You know, when you hear your uncles and aunts tell you stories of what he got up to, you can't feel he's a saint. So I think that's a good thing. And I had that kind of religious belief. And my dad comes from a village where, you know, a lot of dead Europe stories come from dad, including the vampire. So I had this kind of magical, supernatural world that I grew up in. But for a period in high school, I think directly in order to deal with my emerging sexuality, I became a fundamentalist Christian for about a year and a half. Never totally committed, but I just thought, if I punish myself hard enough, maybe I can get rid of this, you know, I'll use the word, what I thought was a cancer, which was my sexuality. And I do remember...
Did you put too much pressure on yourself?
I was putting too much pressure on myself.
Because I think of when I look at your characters even, and even when we're talking now, you know, I mean, it's a sign of the times and it's about being from that generation, but there was so much pressure that you put on yourself to live up to what, your family wanted, but then what you kind of thought you should be. So society pressures.
All of that, I think, and it just, you know, I think for a lot of what happens is that you try and find any valve that will to release some of that pressure. You know, religion was one possibility. But to what I was talking about, the point where I realized, actually, I don't believe this anymore, is when I just thought, then I can jump. You know, if I'm wrong about God, then maybe I'm wrong about everything. And the only way I'm going to find out if I'm wrong is to allow myself to have as much experience as I can. And I think that leap was absolutely crucial and important. And that's where I started to learn a little bit of what it would be to live a life without fear. I don't think that's totally ever going to go away, but that's the beginning of it.
What do you think makes a good writer?
Being a good reader.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm being really serious. I think because there's in terms of narrative fiction, you know, if you're a good storyteller, that's makes you a good writer. In terms of all kind of writing, loving language, you know, and you know, loving language and not being lazy about language, you know, thinking seriously about every word you use. But the way you learn that is through reading. That's how you learn. So, you know, this is just so you understand that this never goes away as a writer. I'm reading a book at the moment, Norman Mailer's Naked and the Dead, which I read first time as a teenager, reading again, I've got this book by the bed with a pen, and if I come across a word that I'm not sure about, I will put it in the book and then I'll look up the dictionary and I will write it down, because I just think that's my trade, is in language and words, and my tools are...
Well, you're musculating the language. You're musculating your ability.
Exactly. It's part of the training. So I think that makes you a good... That's what I mean, that reading makes you a... There's some writing is beyond any way... And there's some art, you know, that you can't capture. That is the word ineffable. You know, the sense of the unknowability of God. It's the unknowability of art. The one that always comes to mind is something like Franz Kafka.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, how that is true genius. We overuse that word. There are not a lot of geniuses of that magnitude. But I can't tell you what makes him a great writer, except because his imagination, his creativity. Feels like beyond human, and it's wonderful that it's human. But I don't know what
some
what
people
it is.
Have a genuine talent, and some people it's a craft.
Yes,
you know, it comes from experience. It keeps from working on it. You get better at it. I mean, you're very critical in lots of ways. Looking over all of the books that you've written now, are you particularly proud of one of them? Do you still go that book there? That's what I. I'm doing this for. I'm proud of that.
I think probably
this is like Sophie's Choice, where I get you to cut up one of your children.
Exactly. How can you do it? I think the book that I am, in that sense, I would have to say Dead Europe, because Dead Europe marked a particular phase in my writing where I thought I can, you know, I can do something different, you know. I can, and it was a it was a very, very hard book to write. It took me a long time, and it came from when I started a real existential question of do I really want to do this? Can I commit to this? And in doing Dead Europe, I realised that yes, this is going to be my life. So that's part of where the pride is in that book. And I think it also taught me that, of course, I will, as I said right at the beginning of this interview, there are always obsessions and wounds that we will, that each individual writer will mine for their work, and Dead Europe certainly is part of that. But it also taught me I can write in different ways.
Do you have a message for the queer community that might be listening to this right now?
So there's not anything I could say to the queer community that isn't what I would say to people in general, which is listen. I think it's really important we listen more, and to not be fearful of debate, to not be fearful of ideas, to not be fearful of the stranger. You know, maybe I've been reading a lot of my Bible, but that's one, even though I'm not a believer now, that's one message in Christianity that I think is important to resurrect. That you owe a care and a generosity to the stranger.
Christos Tsiolkos, thank you so much for being able to be here on
My
Word
friend,
for Word.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the Community Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.